this papacy has been more progressive and more to the left. It's true that EWTN, you know, the detractors would say that they're more to the right and more conservative. They would argue we're kind of just sticking to the gospel and sticking to the truths and the teachings of the Catholic Church. So the people who were around the Vatican, I think, who were more kind of on the left progressive side, I think it was some of them who were having an ear or having a word in Pope Francis's ear and saying, look, this network is not doing good, or they're saying this.
Hello and welcome to the Insights Podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest is one of Ireland's most dynamic and widely travelled journalists, admired for both his human interest storytelling and global reporting. From County Clare, Colm Flynn's passion for broadcasting emerged at a very, very young age. Then he began his professional career with RTE, contributing to programmes like Nationwide and The Today Show, before taking his talents to the international stage, reporting for networks including the BBC and ABC News in the United States. In recent years, Colm has been based in Rome, working as Vatican correspondent for EWTN News, where he's been covering major church-related news stories and events, of course, most recently and currently the death of Pope Francis, and now the forthcoming conclave due to begin on the 7th of May. Arguably one of the busiest reporters working near the Vatican or anywhere else in the world right now, Colm, we appreciate your time and welcome to the Insights Podcast. It must have been close on frenetic in terms of the demands of work in the last 2 weeks or so.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it, Sean, because we know that there has been a huge interest in this papacy overall, because Pope Francis has really not just spoken to Catholics around the world, but people of other faiths and people of no faith at all. But when the news broke that Monday morning, it was around 7:30 local time here in Rome that the Holy Father had passed away, just after we had seen him, the day before, on the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica, you know, giving his Easter greetings to the crowd, within around 6-7 minutes, the phone just lit up. And it was the networks that I know and I'm connected with, like yourselves at RTE and the BBC, but it was a Good Day New Zealand, Australian television, all the networks in the US, German television, World Africa Today from Nairobi. And it's only beginning to slow down a little bit now, but I have just been blown away by the international interest in this papacy, and then, as you say, this upcoming conclave. Because you're right, not only do you have the human element of the politics of the institution of the church, but then you add in the spiritual element to that as well. The fact that these cardinals are coming from different parts of the world, sometimes with wildly different points of view and traditions and cultures. This is going to be one fascinating conclave.
And I would surmise that you've probably spent more time on air than off air in the last 10 days or so, in your waking hours anyway.
Yeah, I've got a home studio set up, which is where I'm talking to you from now. So the great thing is that I can be sitting here, and like the first day, I sat in this seat where I'm sitting at the moment, and you can't see this now, but in front of me, I have a huge television camera, around 5 lights, monitors. So what we were doing was really plugging into one network, you know, 5 minutes with the Dr. Phil network in the US, and then onto Fox News, and then onto CNN, and then onto Newsmax, then over to Sydney, Australia. So we just did them back to back to back, and it was exhausting. And then sometimes the bigger networks who have more resources and money, they would start sending crews here. So once those crews hit the ground, then I would have to switch my time between my home studio here, and I live right next to the Vatican, so it's pretty easy. I could just run out the door, meet a TV crew from Germany, let's say, in front of St. Peter's Square, because they want that basilica in the background, talk to our friends in Berlin or wherever, and then come straight back here. So, but you know, it's been a privilege too, Sean, because, you know, you get to talk about this, not only for, you know, people who are religious, this is a very important moment, the passing of a Holy Father, the waiting for a new Pope, but also just, it's a moment in history. This is a huge moment in history. And to be able to be a part of that coverage in a real kind of central way, It's been an honour.
Right. We'll come back to the conclave and Pope Francis and who the next Pope may or may not be. But I want to go right back to the start, Colm. I did say at the outset that you developed your interest in broadcasting at a very, very young age. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was a bit of a strange child, Sean, if I'm going to be honest about it, because while my friends were running around playing hurling or soccer or whatever it was, I really don't know what it was, but for some reason, at a young age, my dad, Tom, had a camcorder. And I remember just getting it into my hands one day, looking through the viewfinder and just being captivated by both the technology that I could record someone and play it back in a TV, but just the idea of I could talk to someone, I could record a story, I could show it to others, and then I would see, oh, that would make them laugh. People would be listening to that story. They'd be interested. They would be intrigued. Then I started a little newsletter around my neighborhood in Drumcliff where I would print a one A4 sheet. I would go around, I'd ring around the neighbors on the landline before mobile phones and ask them what their news was. And they would humor me and say, well, we're thinking of getting a new car. Or, you know, some of the cows went missing the other day. And I was thinking, And I was writing all this down and I put it into a newsletter. I would go hand it around. I was probably around 12, 11, 12, 13. And then as it went on, I developed a bit and I really focused on television and radio. I was obsessed with the medium. I would watch TV shows. I would listen to people on the radio and, you know, why did they do that? Or if something went wrong, what's going on there? So then it just went on from there. Started when I was 16 in Clare FM radio, worked there for a number of years, and then went up to the Big Smoke, went to college in Tala, and then went to the place where you're sitting now and started banging on the door.
You mentioned your dad, Colm, and I'm wondering about your own family background as well. I mean, I remember interviewing you on the Today with Sean O'Rourke programme on radio many years ago about your family's experience with a young person from Chernobyl.
Yeah, and that's and thank you for remembering that, Sean, because that was a thing that was very, it was a beautiful moment in our life for the family. It was a very, difficult time too. It was tragic, really, to be honest about it. But it was, you know, every summer they have this exchange program. Ireland has just been so wonderful with the children coming out of Chernobyl or that region affected by the radiation, even still today. And through the Burn Chernobyl project and Brother Limo Mara, one day we were at Mass and instead of the sermon, somebody got up and said, look, we're looking for volunteers, host families to take in these children for just, I think it was a couple of weeks. My parents, I was young at the time, but my parents volunteered. And then I remember vividly coming home from school one day. I think I was in sixth class in primary school, went into the sitting room, dropped my school bag, and there was this little Belarusian boy, couldn't speak, couldn't walk, just made kind of sounds, and his name was Banny. And we had him for a few weeks, and we just completely fell in love with him. We kept him for a year, and my parents started the legal process on the Irish side, and then on the Belarusian side. We were all cleared with the Irish authorities to adopt, and then in the end, we were told, no, he has to stay in Belarus. He's a Belarusian child. And sadly, when he turned 18, he was moved to a mental asylum. He has autism. I went back and I made a documentary a few years later. I hadn't seen him in I don't know how many years. And yeah, the good thing that came from that, Sean, is that there was a real heightened awareness for the children in Belarus. A lot of money was raised on the back of it for the children there. But the suffering of them and the plight of those Banny, and Banny is just one of thousands of children in these orphanages, state-run orphanages. I mean, it is, it's horrific. But we did the best we could and we often pray for him.
It was an extraordinarily generous act on behalf of your parents and indeed the whole family to invest so much effort and love into Banny's situation. I'm wondering about the impact it had on you, that experience. I mean, did it kind of spark in you maybe an interest in covering stories like the ones you do now and maybe an interest in religious stories?
Absolutely. I think you're right because I realized at a young age that life can be cruel and life cannot be fair. And there are people suffering. You know, sometimes, Sean, we become very focused and we become very insular on our own life and our own country and what's going on. And that's only natural, of course. You know, we all have our problems and our issues. But I think from going to Belarus and just seeing how horrific the situation was, and then starting off my broadcasting career, I went to South Africa with Nationwide. I went to Ecuador to do another program. And I thought, you know, first of all, I realized how lucky we are. And I know Ireland has its problems with different things, but just how incredibly fortunate and lucky we are. And we often don't realize it. But I think too, Sean, that it gave me an appreciation for the good that the church does. Because here was Brother Limo Mara, a Christian brother, helping these children, you know, not doing it for fame, for fortune, for followers. We live in a world now where people say, how many followers do you have on social media? And it's almost become your worth. But, you know, he wasn't getting any of this, and he was there selflessly helping these children. Then when I went to South Africa, another sister from County Clare, Sister Ethelnor Moyle, who has since passed away, she was there for 60-something years during apartheid, helping the black community when the police force in South Africa were trying to stop her. And at one stage, they kidnapped her and dumped her in the countryside. She worked in a township where there was a huge amount of HIV and AIDS. And I'm like, why are these people doing it? There's got to be something that's driving them. And, you know, sometimes my friends now today who say, oh, Colm, I'm not religious. The church is terrible. The abuse that's happened. And they're absolutely right about those things. But they then say to me, but I saw that program you did on that priest in South Sudan, and he's brilliant. And I often say, Sean, yeah, he is. He's an exception. But then again, he's not. The church is made up of these people. We think the church is just the place I'm talking to you from now, the Vatican and the hierarchy. That's part of it. But the vast majority of the Catholic Church are the people in the slums and the villages and the schools and the hospitals. And you know what? Thank God for them.
And you're there now in the middle of the big international story, or one of the big international stories of our time. But on your way to work in Rome for EWTN, you spent some time, was it about 5 or 6 years in the United States after you finished up with RTE?
Yeah, I'd been working with the John Murray Show on RTE, and we were on just before you, Sean. But when the show finished with John Murray, I was kind of at a crossroads. And let's be honest, I was dropped by RTE. I was, after being there for 5 years, I was brought into an office and I was told in 3 days, you're done. You're out of here. And me, in a bit in my naivety, was like, what? But I've been here for 5 years and we're like a family and this and that. It was a great lesson in broadcasting about when you're needed, and when you're not, you're not. I got great advice at that time from Derek Mooney, actually, of all people. And he said, Colm, get yourself on a plane, head to England or head to the US. And that's exactly what I did. I packed my stuff and I flew as soon as I could, get a visa, and I went to New York. It was the best decision I ever made.
What did you do there?
I had no work to do. I had a rule, which was 5 by 9. And I told myself, you have to send 5 emails to 5 different shows before 9 a.m. So I would wake up every morning. I would go to a kind of a diner in Midtown Manhattan. So I would sit there and I started banging emails to anyone I could find. Deutsche Welle Germany, Radio France International. I looked at all the international broadcasters, the big ones, who had an English arm. And one day I got a call from a guy, Richard Hooper was his name, at the World Service. And he said, oh, Colm, got your ideas. Don't like the first one. Don't like the second one. Don't like the third one. Don't like the fourth one. The fifth one. Yeah, let's go for that. That was the first one. And then it led to more. And then the tide turns where they realize, hey, he's kind of good at this. He delivers. I started doing more stuff for television. And that's when I really started doing more with EWTN. Because I think, unlike Ireland, in Ireland at that time when I left, maybe it was kind of the best thing at the best time. There was a real pushback against the church, understandably, because of all the scandals. But in the US, there was still this openness to faith, to Christianity. And people were more willing to talk about it on camera. So that's where I found the reservoir of stories at that time.
Now, tell me about EWTN, Colm. I understand it's based there in Alabama. It was started by a nun about, what, 30 or 40 years ago? But it's quite a controversial station, very, very influential, huge number of viewers and listeners. Tell me a bit more about it.
Yeah, and I mean, the controversy, depending on who you ask, and I think when you get to a certain size and you're outputting so much programming and content, you're always going to have your supporters and your detractors. But it is the most fascinating thing, Sean, because I grew up watching EWTN at home. We had RT1, 2, TV3, TG Car, and then my dad went and bought a satellite dish just so we could get EWTN. It is the largest religious broadcaster in the world. We broadcast in English. My wife, Paola, she's on the Spanish-speaking network. We're going out live in German, Hungarian. We now have an office in Iraq for the Arabic service. It's, I think, 1,000 staff all over the world on radio, online too. It has become kind of a phenomenon.
It's been widely acknowledged and recognized and criticized as being a very orthodox station editorially. In fact, I think Pope Francis had a bit of a dig at them, more than a bit, 4 or 5 years ago, where he talked about a large Catholic television channel that has no hesitation in continually speaking ill of the Pope. I personally deserve attacks and insults because I am a sinner, but the church does not deserve them. They are the work of the devil.
of the devil. Yeah. And you know what? Before we mention that, I was actually on the plane going to Iraq with the Pope when he made that historic journey. And I had just started full time with EWTN. And I remember when we met him, and I said, oh, we're praying for you, Holy Father. And he said to my colleague and I, we had our EWTN badges on. He said, pray for me. Don't pray against me. And then it was later when he was in Hungary talking to the Jesuits, he made that comment where he said, this is the work of the devil. But, you know, I'll preface this by saying I'm not a spokesperson for EWTN. And I'm a reporter, I'm a contractor, and I can stand over anything I've ever done on the network, any interview, any production. But the reality is, you know, Sean, is Pope Francis sitting down watching cable television? He's not. Was he watching EWTN? I don't think so. This papacy has been more progressive and more to the left. It's true that EWTN, you know, the detractors would say that they're more to the right and more conservative. They would argue, we're kind of just sticking to the gospel and sticking to the truths and the teachings of the Catholic Church. So the people who were around the Vatican, I think, who were more kind of on the left progressive side, I think it was some of them who were having an ear or having a word in Pope Francis's ear and saying, look, this network is not doing good, or they're saying this. And there is one show the world over who have in the past criticized, and not even criticized, just challenged and talked about some of the issues coming out of the pontificate. And that leads into the question, Sean, can people challenge, can they critique a papacy? Can they say, well, look, we're not sure about what the Pope has said, and how do Catholics feel about it? And what I would say in that show's defense, and I've never worked in that show or had any part in the production, but I know that what they do broadcast represents the views of not a minority in the Catholic Church. You know, they like to sometimes say, oh, the conservatives in America, you go past the Southern Hemisphere into Africa, Asia. What they were challenging, or the voice they were giving to Catholics, is a huge chunk of the Catholic Church. Now, do they deserve to have a voice on air? And like, when I look at what I've done on EWTN over the past couple of years, every single trip the Pope has gone on, we have went with them to very dangerous places, showing the beauty of the papacy, those lovely moments. We put our money where our mouth is. And what I mean by that is every time the Pope, before he passed, would come out to the window at his apostolic palace or the balcony, we would cut to that on TV, radio, online, uninterrupted, not through any analysis or prism. And that costs a lot of money. But I think with a big network, it's good to have a diversity of opinion. If you just got one kind of viewpoint of a papacy, well, then you're not really getting an honest view.
That's precisely the thing that EWTN arguably lacks, because it's just, I mean, I take your point fully, by the way, about you're not a spokesperson. But nonetheless, I mean, for instance, you mentioned that that program, The World Over, where, you know, the presenter, a fellow called Raymond Arroyo, he has interviewed, I think he could be described as the schismatic formal papal nuncio in the United States, Archbishop Vigano, who previously called for the resignation of Pope Francis.
That interview was, I think, 5 years ago. And again, I would say that when you're on air 24 hours a day in six different languages, pumping out shows, it's easy to take one interview, maybe a couple of years ago, which, you know, I would have my own view in it and think, did they do that right? Did they do that wrong? I think there were mistakes made. And I think EWTN would admit that as well. But just like an RTE or the BBC, they go, huh, we hit the mark there, we missed the mark there. But I can honestly say, hand on heart, that out of all the reports I've done, and sometimes on controversial issues, like debates in the Synod about the future of the Church, or when I came to Ireland recently and interviewed people about the recent wave of abuse crises coming out of the Church, I've never felt pressure coming from Alabama or coming from here to say, Cullum, you know what, we need to push that this way or this way. But the funny thing is, with the BBC, I have. I remember making a program on I did the official obituary program for the BBC World Service about the life and legacy of Pope Benedict XVI. And I remember having long, drawn out discussions with my editor at the time, who's there no longer. And I felt more pressure there to kind of make it skew one way when I really thought it wasn't objective or fair to the papacy. And I work not just with EWTN, with BBC, with RTE still, with lots of different people. So I found EWTN to be one of the best people to work with.
And I suppose what we've been talking about, it really is a reflection of the tensions within the church during the Francis papacy over the last 12 years, and indeed now in the run into the conclave, that there was a sense on the part of maybe more traditional people that he was trying to introduce reform by stealth. I mean, you're thinking of the references, for instance, in one of those documents to allowing people who were divorced and remarried to receive communion. There was the reference to the blessing of people in same-sex relationships. And on the one hand, people who want to change were a bit impatient that he didn't go far enough. People who were more traditional and conservative were suspicious of any move he made.
You know, when you were talking about that split, it's a bit like politics in the US, the split between the left and the right. We've seen that really clear divide in the Catholic Church at the moment. And maybe, you know, it was emphasized during Pope Francis's pontificate, as you said. But again, when I was on CNN the other night, and Anderson Cooper asked me about, well, you know, what about the, you know, the conservatives in America? And I had to cut across them and I say, look, forget about focusing on the conservatives in America. This isn't the American Catholic Church, nor is it the Irish Catholic Church. This is the global Catholic Church. And what you think might be this fringe, you go to anywhere in Africa or in Asia. Like last year, I went to Kenya and I went to Uganda to do reports there. And I remember sitting down with the bishop in Nairobi, the most powerful diocese in the whole country. And he was telling me that, you know, in our country, just like in Ireland, we have a crisis of vocations. And I said, you have a crisis of vocations? What do you mean? He said, we have too many and we don't have enough space to put them. The opposite to what we have shown in Ireland. But I asked him then, what was your reaction to Pope Francis's pontificate? And he said, well, you know, he said, we will always stand by the Holy Father. Africa will never deviate from the Holy Father. But it is the people here who look to us when, for example, the Vatican announced by Pope Francis that a blessing could be given to those in same-sex unions. He said it was the people here in Africa who were appalled. And they went to the church and the bishop saying, what is this? Is this still the gospel? Are we straying from the gospel? And he told me that the other Christian churches around there used it as a way to take people from the Catholic faith, saying, look, they're straying from the gospel now. They're not staying true to the dogma. But that was something that Pope Francis often talked about as well. He said cultural, ideological colonization. Because with Pope Francis, because you had that divide, I think that divide came from a lot of confusion. Because on one hand, Pope Francis would say, who am I to judge, when he was asked about people in same-sex relationships? And he would say as well, now we can give a blessing, not to the union, by the way. He said, not to the union, to the individuals within that union. And they would go viral all over the world, Sean. But then when he was asked to kind of further explain, he said, oh yeah, but by the way, the sacrament of marriage will never change. It cannot change and it will never change. And I don't want to try and change it. So I think that's what caused a lot of the confusion. There was this room left for discussion on all topics. But at the end of the day, like you said, the reformists thought he didn't go far enough. I think sometimes, I don't think it was ever Pope Francis's intention to go any further. I think he wanted people to talk about all the issues. He wanted them to be up for grabs in the synod. But at the end of the day, he didn't want to change any of the fundamental teachings.
Right. But when you see or hear or read of people like, for instance, the German cardinal, I don't think he has a vote on it, Gerhard Müller, saying, look, the next pope needs to be strong on doctrine and determined to stand up to ideological lobbies, and others talking about the need for unity. Then some other cardinals, like there's a Canadian man who said, look, that's just code for rolling back what Pope Francis was trying to achieve. So it's a fascinating and a very interesting time, but I'd imagine there are all sorts of machinations going on as we speak in Rome. What's your sense of it?
My sense is, who knows? I love that saying, you know, that the people who know are not talking and the people who are talking don't actually know. And I certainly don't want to fall into that latter category, because every network that I'm on now, they're asking, you know, okay, so who's next? Who's the one? And I keep saying, well, you know, we believe that it's not the Holy Spirit who picks them, but we hope that the Holy Spirit will inspire these men. Because, you know, when we look back in history, we have had some terrible popes who've done terrible things way back in the day. So I think it's unfair to say that it's always the Holy Spirit's hand who picks them. But they will have to decide, Sean, when they're in that conclave, locked into the Sistine Chapel in just a few days, do we want to continue that pontificate? Do we want a Pope Francis 2.0? Did that work? did it work on a PR scale, like in terms of the church's outreach to people, but did it actually get people into the pews? Are there more people coming into the seminary? And as you say, you have cardinals coming from Germany, some conservative, but some more liberal. Germany was actually one of the most progressive parts of the Catholic Church over the past couple of years. Pope Francis even had to bring the bishops from Germany. He summons them to Rome and kind of slapped them on the wrist at one point, saying, look, you're actually taking this a bit too far. And then you've got the bishops, the cardinals coming up from Africa who are saying, look, in South Sudan, we are not that concerned about LGBT issues. We're not that concerned about environmental issues. We're not concerned at all about the synod and synodality. We need to build roads. We need to build schools, hospitals, and we've got problems like polygamy. We've got problems like witchcraft we have to deal with in certain rural places. We need a future pope who will focus on that. And then you'll have another cardinal coming from Mongolia saying, look, we really need to focus on interreligious dialogue. You'll have the Cardinal Sacco, who I interviewed just a month ago in Iraq. You'll have him coming from Kurdistan saying, we need a future pope that will really focus on interreligious dialogue and stop Christian persecution. So in the past, most of the cardinals, Sean, were Italian, or they were French, or they were European. So they kind of all came from the same point of view or the same lived experience. But Pope Francis, in an effort, he wanted to reflect the true universality of the church in all its diversity. He has created cardinals in Mongolia, in Papua New Guinea, in South Sudan, in Madagascar. So on one hand, they all have different priorities they want to push. A lot of them come from more traditional conservative backgrounds, but also they don't know each other that well. So we're wondering, how is this going to play out? We believe that's why they've pushed the beginning of the conclave back a bit, just to give them a chance to actually say, well, who is this guy again? Where are you from again? What's your first name? What do you believe in?
From what you say, Colm, this suggestion, because I think Pope Francis personally appointed some 80% of the, well, I think between illnesses and one or two stepping back, something like 133 elector cardinals who will assemble in the Sistine Chapel on the 7th of May. If he appointed 80% of them, surely there has to be a strong expectation that there will be the new pope will be some largely in his in Francis's image and likeness. Or from what you were saying, maybe not.
If you were, looking at the bet he nods, you would think that if he's flooding the College of Cardinals, the likelihood that his successor will share his vision and priorities is probably hugely increased. But I was talking to another Vatican analyst the other day who's been here around the mill for decades, and he was saying, the problem with the Pope Francis's pontificate is that sometimes he was seen by some as a little bit sporadic and spur of the moment. And many of these people who were appointed cardinals, you know, like I remember when I went to Mongolia and everyone was surprised that this bishop, who was only 45 years of age, was instantly created a cardinal. If Pope Francis said, oh, you're working with people on the margins and you're helping the suffering in a rural part of the world, sometimes he would just kind of bang, you're a cardinal. Whereas in the past, you would have kind of worked in one of the dicasteries here. You would have been known. You would have worked up to that point to get that red hat. So someone made the interesting point to me that although we might assume that they could be more liberal and progressive just because they were appointed, it's not often the case. And you can't bet on that. And it's going to be interesting because, you know, it's not like politicians, where politicians will advocate for themselves. No cardinal will stand up in front of his brother cardinals and say, look, you got to vote for me because I'll make a good pope. But like politicians, they do have policies that they run on. So each one will have the opportunity to make their pre-conclave speech, and they'll stand up in front of the whole 135 people who are eligible to vote, and they will outline their vision for the church. And they'll say, here's where I think we need to bring it in the future. Here's where the emphasis should be. So that is kind of them setting out their stall. But again, with all these different experiences and points of view, and things we'd never even think of, Sean. Like when I was in Papua New Guinea with the Pope last year, I met the cardinal there in the capital, and I said to him, okay, so what's the biggest issue here? Is it poverty? Is it this? And he looked at me and he said, no, it's people killing each other in the jungle, tribal violence. We have to stop them killing each other. When I went to Uganda and I asked the bishop there, so what's the problem here? And he said, polygamy. When we go into villages and people want to become Catholics and they already have maybe 3, 4, 5 wives, what does the church do? So they christen the man and they say, okay, you can enter. But the first woman you married, she is now the legitimate wife in the eyes of the church. But then the other 4 that you're living with, you have to treat them like maybe sisters, have that loving family relationship. It's just fascinating when you go around the world, the church in Australia, dealing with the Aboriginal community. These things that we never even think of, they're all going to start playing into this conclave. And even if they're not that heavy in this one, Sean, as the church becomes more globally south, in future ones, it's going to be, you know, more kind of traditional, I think, church.
Just thinking, Colin, that your listeners here in Ireland will be familiar with, you know, poorly attended churches in which perhaps in many cases the average age of congregations and indeed clergy would be probably over 70. But you have a much bigger picture look at it from your travels. How many journeys did you actually make with the Pope?
With the Pope, I think I went to around 7 or 8 countries with him on the actual plane. But then many other countries I would go before him, because what we found was that when you travel with the Pope, it's a bit like traveling with the president. You're in an entourage and you're surrounded by the security and you have to go with the Pope, obviously, on his schedule. So you're up early in the morning at the Papal Palace in Hungary or wherever it may be. And then you're going on to meet the Prime Minister. You're part of the media delegation. So it's hard to actually get something different and to get good substantive interviews with people. So I said to my bosses once, I think it was after Iraq, I said, look, that was brilliant and we got incredible stuff, but let's go 2 or 3 weeks beforehand. So when he announced he was going to Canada and to try and, you know, apologize for the what happened in the industrial schools and everything, I said, well, let's go 2.5 weeks beforehand where we can talk to the cardinals and we can get in and talk to the Aboriginal people. And so I found that really worked well. And then often we would just stay on in the country. So when he went to Mongolia, because it was so far away, I said, well, look, let's travel there in between Russia and China. I'll spend 2 weeks traveling across this huge country, really getting a sense of what are Catholics thinking, what are the issues, and then we'll be there when the Pope is on the ground as well. So we could get the build up and then we could see the impact of when the Pope lands and it's kind of boots on the ground.
I can get a sense of what you meant when you're talking about it being a EWTN being a well-resourced broadcaster. When you went to those places, presumably, you know, you picked up phone numbers of high churchmen and you've probably got a good, well, whatever the Latter-day equivalent of a contact book is. I mean, do you find it easy to access the cardinals who you would have dealt with before and who will be going into that conclave next week?
Yeah, they're all keeping tight-lipped. And it's funny, Sean, watching them even last night when I was standing beside the Vatican and they were coming out of the Paul VI hall where they're having their pre-conclave discussions and meetings, their congregations. They're flanked by journalists because of the movie Conclave and because of the movie, you know, the two popes and all this. They're seen as like mini celebrities at the moment. And there was a huge scrum of journalists and flashing photographers and microphones from all over the world. And these cardinals are saying, no comment, no comment. And they're making jokes. It's actually hilarious to see here at the moment. But in terms of people picking up the phone, I mean, we are well placed in that we are such a huge network now. But as we talked about a while ago, the divide within the church, you know, being completely honest with you, Sean, that there's some cardinals I will call and they'll say, boom, I'll be on air with you in 10 minutes. And there are other cardinals who will hang up the phone on me just because of maybe what I would see as misconceptions about EWTN and how we do things. But I think overall, we can't worry about that. And we can't worry about sometimes what the public thinks. We have to just do what we think is right, good, honest journalism. And I think that's what we've been doing.
Would they talk to you off the record much?
Maybe not the cardinals, but the people around the cardinals will be saying, look, you know, for example, they were saying that there was a lot of upset cardinals because they started the meetings, the congregation, just 2 days after the Pope passed away, these preliminary meetings. But of course, the cardinals who were in and around Rome, they could get here much faster. Cardinals who are further afield, and they were saying, this is ridiculous. How, this is so unfair. I've got to travel for 2 or 3 days to get to Rome. They can't start those meetings without us because it gives them an unfair advantage to maybe shape the themes or the issues that that group of cardinals might want to push in the conclave. Now, the Vatican were actually challenged about this, and they said, no, no, these are just administrative meetings, and we're talking about logistics and this and that. But of course, Sean, as you can imagine, if these group of cardinals are together, you know, the obvious things are going to come up about, well, you know, how is this conclave going to go? Who are we thinking about? Are the themes? So that's kind of been settled at the moment. All of the cardinals are here and they're in place and they're ready to go. But off the record, there's not really much to talk about. Everyone has their, you know, their 2 cents and who's going to do it. But when I was in the gym this morning, before we came on to do this, the lady, I got barely any work done because the lady behind the desk came over. She'd seen me on TV doing something and she kept telling me, I think it's going to be Cardinal Pizzaballa. I really think because he is this and that. And then yesterday I met a group from the Philippines who think it will be our Tagle, Cardinal Tagle from Manila, because we call him the Asian Pope Francis and he is so humble and nice. And then I meet someone else who said, call him, no, no. It's not any of the top 10 that we're talking about. It's going to be an outlier. I know it is. It's going to be someone from the peripheries. So it's
the scariest time I ever had in my career, or one of them, was the day that the successor to John Paul was elected. I was stuck high above that audience hall you mentioned in a little radio booth. And it was when the white smoke had gone up, right? It is not the time to be making rash observations or predictions because we know the Pope has been elected. And on one side of the booth, I had Radio Columbia. And on the other side of the booth, in the next booth, was Radio Na Gaeltacht. And the two presenters were, they were giving it socks and they were, you know, sort of, they were. I could see, I couldn't hear, but I could see them. And they were yapping away good. And I said, God, what do those guys know? And I had an open line back to Dublin. I had pictures, no sound, and no, the text couldn't come through, right? So not the time to be, as I say, saying I think it will be so-and-so, because you'll be proved wrong very quickly. And then when the whole thing was over and the man came forward, it was Pope Benedict.
And you know what, Sean, about Ratzinger, because the fascinating thing about him was that he had been in Rome for something like 20, 25 years working at in different dicasteries around the Vatican. And, you know, at his height, what an intellect. He could speak like 7 or 8 languages. So all of these cardinals knew him personally from coming in and out of Rome. And they all felt like they had this kind of one-on-one personal relationship with him because he could speak their tongue. So a lot of them thought, well, if he gets in and he's the Pope, I'll have a direct line to the Holy Father. But you're right. And what I'm really worried about, Sean, is that I'm live on CNN or RT or whatever it may be, and I'm watching the balcony and they come out and then I'm like, and they turn to me and go, well, Cullum, what can you tell us about him? And I'm looking going, who is that cardinal and where is he from? Even this morning, actually, I was going through the list of cardinals I've interviewed over the past couple of years, and I was talking to my producer and they were saying, remember when you interviewed Cardinal Aberelius? And I was like, who's Cardinal Aberelius? And they said, Sweden. I said, oh yeah, he won Man of the Year in Sweden. Did we do an interview with him? And they said, yeah, you flew to Stockholm to do it a few years ago. And I'm like, oh, I got to do my homework and watch that again. And I was going through Cardinal Dolan of New York, Cardinal Rossi of Argentina just a few months ago, Cardinal Tagle of the Philippines, Cardinal Grech from Malta. I was going through all these names going, oh yeah, okay, I've interviewed him, Parolin. We did that in Dubai. Cardinal Da Silva in Papua New Guinea, we just mentioned. Ignatius Suhero in Indonesia. We did that interview. What did he say again? Where does he stand? I interviewed the Cardinal, the new one from Japan recently as well, from Tokyo. Although there are 135 who can vote, technically any can be picked. That's, you know, as long as they're a cardinal, they can be picked. In fact, the rule is by canonical law that any baptized man in the world could technically be picked. Now, it will never happen. But I have to really do my homework. And that's my biggest worry, is that someone will come.
You must have a short list of, say, you know, 8 or 10. I mean, it may or may not be one of them. And you've, you know, underlined those caveats. But, you know, who are the ones you'd be paying closest attention to?
People much smarter than I. And that wouldn't be very difficult to have people smarter than me. But it's the ones that people are talking about around here mainly are Italians. And for some reason, there is a sense around the Vatican, whether this is will be right or not, after Pope Francis being the first Latin American Pope. In fact, when I was in Argentina a week ago, someone told me, we have a saying here, after he was such a disruptor, that Pope Francis was the first Latin American Pope and also the last Latin American Pope. But the sense is that after someone from Argentina, Benedict from Germany, Pope John Paul II from Poland, that to steady the ship a bit, it will go back to an Italian. And the front runner at the moment, people say, is Pietro Parolin. He is the current second in command at the Vatican. He's the biggest and most experienced diplomat.
Here's the thing, though, about Cardinal Parolin. He's Secretary of State, and he's the guy who did that deal with the Chinese, which has been a source of a lot of controversy, because effectively it gives the Chinese regime a veto over appointments of bishops of the Catholic Church in China. It was a deal that was available to Francis' two predecessors. They didn't take it, and it really got up the noses of people who would be more traditional, no?
Absolutely. But I think even people that aren't on the more traditional side, I think level-headed people would look at this and go, this doesn't sound good to me, that, okay, we can allow bishops, but the Chinese Communist Party is going to select them first before we get to pick from the shortlist. I mean, I think many Catholics, where they fall, would be like, that doesn't sound too hot to me. But, and this is one of the things, going back to our previous point in the conversation, is one of the things that EWTN would really delve into, and they would challenge and they would explore with different guests, which I think is a good thing, because the amount of Catholics in China, you have the state Catholic Church, if you will, inverted commas, and then you have the underground Catholic Church. I don't envy their position, the Vatican, trying to please both and look after both Catholics. It's a very difficult position they were in. But yeah, this deal with China, which, by the way, Sean, China has broke on a number of occasions with no repercussions really from the Vatican. Even just 2 years ago, I think it was, after they had made this deal very publicly saying, look, okay, we'll go 50-50. China, you pick a short list of people you think would be suitable to be the bishops in different dioceses, and then we'll have the final call. Are we in agreement with that, Beijing? Yes, we are. Okay. And then all of a sudden, Beijing announced, we have now announced a new bishop of Shanghai. And everyone went, what? The Vatican first heard about it coming through the news. And they released a statement saying, we're very disappointed at this. I thought we had an agreement. And then an international, very well-respected international security firm said that the Vatican had been attacked by China as well. There was a cybersecurity attack that they were taking documents. So it's a very difficult relationship. And yeah, Parolin was at the heart of that, but he is still seen as someone who is well-respected across the globe, working hard to try and bring about peace in, you know, between Israel and Palestine, in Ukraine at the moment as well. So he's well-liked by world leaders. But Sean, the problem is he wouldn't have, let's say, the charisma of someone like Pope Francis. But then you have other people like Pete Zabala. He's another Italian. He's seen as a shrewd operator. Again, another person who's working. He's the custodian of the Holy Land. So he's trying to bring about peace there. And if Pope Francis has put you in positions like that of great importance, it's kind of a wink and a nod and a point towards you as being someone who maybe could be a successor. But then you have Tagle, who I mentioned from the Philippines. He is seen as someone like Pope Francis who has come from the periphery, surrounded by a lot of poverty. He knows what it's like to see suffering on his doorstep. He's very humble. He's very likable. He's seen as a contender as well.
Colm, you know, we could spend the day speculating. The news will be out in, well, a relatively short time. But just before I let you go, I want to ask you about somebody you mentioned in very briefly, but who will have been seen by viewers of the Dahi and Maura Today show. This is the woman who works with you in EWTN, Paula. Now, you see, people listening to you would have said, God, how come that guy didn't become a priest? So, I mean, so maybe you gave that some consideration, but then when you decided not to, how did Paula emerge into the scene?
I'm 37 and, you know, at a certain age, you're probably thinking, oh, quiet moments when I was sitting in church, looking up at the altar. And I've had the privilege of getting to meet really great, I would call holy people, holy men and women all over the world who are just doing incredible things for the faith. And that would inspire you. And I would think, am I being called to be a priest, or could I be a priest that's still involved in media? You know, it was always kind of in the back of my mind. And then one day I met this beautiful girl from El Salvador, who was working here in Rome. She was reporting for Telemundo on NBC. So she was the very exotic and stunningly beautiful reporter going back to Latin America. I was the sweaty mess standing beside her broadcasting in English. And we got talking and I asked her to go for lunch and she said yes. And the rest is history. We dated for a while, not long, or maybe a year and a half. I proposed. And then 6 months later, we got married. She's a little bit younger. She's 10 years younger than me, but we are just like a match made in heaven. She's the biggest blessing in my life. And you know what? Actually, when I talk about covering Pope Francis's papacy, it was covering Pope Francis that led us two together, which is something I'll be always grateful to Pope Francis for, and this job. And just before he went to hospital, actually, Sean, because we got married in December in Ireland, we went on our honeymoon to Florida. I had to stay on a few weeks in Florida to do some work things. She came back to Rome. And when I came back in February, she said, you know, every Wednesday, there's the general audience where you can meet the Pope. And if you're newlyweds, you can go up near the front. But because we're newlyweds and we work with the Vatican in connection with it, we had our passes so we could go up a little bit closer. So she said to me, Colm, tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning, I want us to get up really early and queue and go in for that. And I said, Sean, no, I don't want to do it, Paula. I'm exhausted. I'm after coming back from Florida. We'll do it next week. We've so many opportunities to meet the Pope. I just want to sleep in. And she insisted. And this was my first lesson of always listen to your wife, because I said, okay, we went in, we got right up near the front. And watching the Pope speak, you could see he was out of breath. He was struggling to get through his sentences. But lo and behold, he came down. He stopped with us because she can speak Spanish, obviously. He signed his autobiography. He blessed an icon of the Holy Family. I spoke to him for a little bit about, oh, I went to Mongolia with you, Iraq. And he smiled and he gave us a blessing. And that was his last ever Wednesday audience, his general audience. He went to hospital. And then we all know what happened after that. So it was an incredible, incredible blessing.
Quite quite clearly, Colin Flynn, you have been the right man in the right place at the right time. And that's just another example of it. Colin, it's been a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you. Wish you the best in the coming time. And you're going to be busy, but I suspect you're going to find the whole experience fairly exhilarating. Colin Flynn, Vatican correspondent for EWTN and contributor to many more outlets, including RTE. Colin Flynn, thank you so much.
Sean, my pleasure. And thank you so much for having me on.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.